In March 1988, two best friends went to enjoy their last night of spring break. After shopping at the mall, going to a party, trying to buy some booze, and meeting up with some work friends, the two girls disappeared. Their car was found 2 days later, but there was no signs of where these teenagers went. These two girls have never been found and are considered missing to this day. What happened to Susan Smalley and Stacy Madison?
Killing. Missing. Hidden. A podcast about bad things.
Welcome, welcome, welcome in, everybody. This is your old buddy Brad, and you are listening to the Killing, Missing, Hidden podcast, also known by the hip kids as the KMH podcast. Welcome into our show today. As usual, we're going to hold off on all business till the end, and we'll just jump right into the story, because for some reason you people want to hear more about the story and less about me. Don't know why. I find it insulting, but here I am doing my public service. Before we get into it, though, tricked you. I just want to note that this is a listener request from our very own listener, Chloe, who we love and adore. Now, she sent in a challenging one. I'll give her that. But we love listener requests, so we'll take on the challenge proudly. March 1988, the year that gave us Rain Man, Coming to America, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Twins, Big, and Die Hard on the silver screen. Radios were playing Faith, Sweet Child of Mine, Pour Some Sugar on Me, Simply Irresistible, and the never dying Never Gonna Give You Up by Mr. Rick Astley. The small screen was dominated by shows such as The Cosby Show, Roseanne, A Different World, Cheers, and Who's the Boss? Popular fashion included brands like Ocean Pacific, LA Gear, Calvin Klein, and Nike. Trying to set a scene here, some context. This is the world this crime occurred in. I hope it's working. So Carrollton, Texas was no different. Spring break was wrapping up on the evening of March 19th. Best friends Susan Smalley and Stacy Madison wanted to make their last night of freedom count. Susan, who was 18, was an honor roll student and dreamed of moving to Florida. She had brown hair and striking green eyes. Susan was very outgoing, and everybody loved her glowing personality. Stacy, who was 17, was a cute blonde girl with blue eyes and a fantastic smile. She also drove a very flashy 1967 Mustang convertible that had been custom painted into her school colors. Yes, these were like the hot chicks from a teen 80s movie. That's intended to be a compliment, though I could see where not everybody would take it that way. So on March 19th, again, this is the last Saturday of spring break of their senior year, the girls decide to have a sleepover at Susan's house. Interestingly, there's reports that Stacy was kind of hesitant to do the sleepover and kind of hinted towards her mom, like, tell me I can't go. Don't give me permission. Their evening, however, went on, and it began, of all places, at the mall. Shockingly, they left the mall to give Susan's mom, who worked at the mall, a ride home. Then they headed to a friend's party in Arlington. It's about 25 minutes away from Carrollton. To give you some basic geography of Texas, in case you're not familiar with it, Arlington's kind of west of Dallas, and Carrollton's roughly on the north side. They hung out at this party till around 10 o'clock and then returned to Susan's home. Stacy made a call to a friend back in Arlington once they arrived home. Then the girls went back out. They went to the restaurant Susan worked at and were there around 11:30. They stayed till close to closing, but they had to get home for their midnight curfew. Now, while they went to the restaurant, Susan was the only one who went inside. Stacy stayed in her car. Doesn't explain why. On their way home, they tried to buy some alcohol from a local 7-Eleven, but the clerk refused to sell them any because, you know, they're minors. They raced home. I think I remember reading that the phone records show that Stacy called her mom at 12:01 a.m. to report that they had made it home by curfew. They then went back out. That would be the last contact anybody had with either Stacy or Susan. The girls were reported missing the next morning, which again would be Sunday. It's obvious that neither one of them had slept at Susan's house. The beds they slept in were still perfectly made, unlike what a teenager would do. Stacy's Mustang was missing. It was found 2 days later at a popular strip mall in Dallas. Lots of teenagers would go there because it had a movie theater and this kind of old-school drive-in hamburger place. So it was pretty popular with the kids. The doors were locked, the convertible was up, and the girls had left their jackets draped over a boombox in the back seat. That's a little noteworthy because it was 45 degrees the morning the girls were reported missing, so leaving their jackets behind is a touch unusual. Believing this to be a case of just two mere runaways, police did no forensic analysis or investigation on the car. I'm talking about they didn't even dust for fingerprints. Which, when you're playing Monday morning quarterback on a crime investigation, probably not a good move. Even the current detective on the case, a fellow by the name of Greg Ward, was quoted as saying the original investigation really wasn't top-notch. Quote, "I'm not saying they screwed up, but they probably could have handled it better." You know, for one officer to say that to another is kind of like a slap to the face. The families immediately began demanding that the police treat this case as a serious crime rather than just two kids who were running away. They had no problems at home. They had no problems at school. They were both just about to graduate from high school and had lots of plans about what they were going to do. I mean, that very morning, Stacy had taken the SATs. It didn't make sense for the girls to want to go and start a new life somewhere when they were so close to entering a brand new phase of their own life. Eventually, police agreed and began working on the theory that the girls were abducted. Two witnesses who were found claimed to have seen Stacy and Susan the night of their disappearance hanging out at a popular drag racing strip in a warehouse district. However, no one else could substantiate the story. Police asked for help from a local psychic, a fellow by the name of John Ketchings. For 3 hours, John and the police sat and talked about this case. Ketchings said the teenagers had been abducted by a white man between the ages of 28 to 34. He had glasses and blonde hair, but the girls were killed and their bodies were left near Lake Grapevine. The police went to the area and thoroughly searched, found nothing. Police, once they made the public aware of this case and kind of started dragging the media into it, received a slew of just like randomly generated tips almost. One call was that the girls were kidnapped and taken to Mexico against their will. Another claimed the girls were seen in a Houston supermarket. Another call said that this person saw the girls at a saloon in West Virginia. Oh, if that was true, that would be such a great story. And yet another call claimed that one of the girls visited an inmate at a prison in Florida. All of these tips led to dead ends, even the saloon in West Virginia. Police also received an anonymous phone call wherein the caller only said, "Susan and Stacy are all right," before hanging up. Stacy's family, who was very frustrated with the lack of police progress in the investigation, hired a private investigator, but ended up firing him after he failed to produce any leads, find any new information, but still charged the family over $3,000 for his services. Now, having said all this, you're sitting there thinking, like I was, well, shoot, they ain't got nowhere to go on this. There was one major suspect the police kind of focused on. Stacy's boyfriend, Kevin Elrod. Now, classmates and neighbors claimed that Elrod was pretty abusive towards Stacy. And Stacy had been trying to figure out a way to end the relationship before spring break began. There are internet rumors, the best kind of rumors, that he was furious that night because Stacy would not come pick him up from work after his shift the night that the girls disappeared. He apparently did not have a vehicle of his own, and Stacy was his personal Uber. Shortly after Stacy disappeared, Elrod began dating another girl. Shortly into the relationship, Elrod confessed to his new girlfriend that he was the one responsible for Stacy and Susan's disappearance. He claimed he killed them with a shovel and buried the teenagers near a cemetery just outside of Carrollton off of Highway 121. Digging around, it looks like to me he's claiming he buried the girls in what is called Ritter Cemetery, which is part of a nature reserve near Louisville Lake. The new girlfriend, smartly, went immediately to the police to share the story. Police claimed to have searched the location but didn't find any of the girls' bodies. Police also decided it may be cool to pick up Elrod and talk to him. Surprisingly, Elrod admitted that he told his girlfriend this, but immediately recanted the statement to the extent it was a confession. He said he claimed he told that story because everybody was asking what happened to Stacy. He was tired of answering the questions. He felt like everybody thought he had something to do with it, and he decided just to take credit for it. Surprisingly, he took a polygraph test and passed. Elrod shortly thereafter moved to Florida and changed his name, as the innocent often do. Apparently, he developed a pattern of moving from town to town throughout Florida, so it was kind of tough to keep dibs on him. Fortunately, he remained on the legal system's radar, at least in Florida, because his now ex-wife took out a restraining order on him after he threatened to kill her with a knife. I think, from my research, he is now known either as Jason Lawson or Kevin Slater. Excuse me. Now, we've talked about Elrod's little discussion with the police and his confession and all that, and that's wonderful. But one of the big problems is the police did not talk to Elrod for over 3 months after the girls went missing. They waited over 90 days to talk to this dude, who many classmates and neighbors would have pointed the finger at immediately. And that be all the facts we have in this one. Chloe really sent us a challenging one. Now, I am slightly derelict in my duties. There is a book that is widely praised called The Night Wounds Time by Sean Sutherland, which I was unable to read for this podcast. That's the downside of producing a weekly show, is I don't have much time to prepare for each episode as I would like. I mean, I guess I could work a few episodes ahead and it would avoid problems like this, but I'm just far too big of a mess of a human being to ever be that efficient. But if you are interested in this case and want to learn more, check out this book. Again, it's called The Night Wounds Time. It was less than $10 on Amazon when I looked, and I've read several articles that said the investigation by Sutherland into this book uncovered enough evidence that the local police decided to reopen this investigation. And they didn't just reopen it. They basically started from scratch to try to chase down new information and not be colored by the poor investigation that was originally done. Again, if you're interested, there's also a Facebook group that's dedicated to keeping these two girls' memories alive. I've got a link to the group in our show notes if you want to go check it out and follow it. They do events on the girls' birthdays and on the day that the girls went missing. And there's lots of people in there who try to offer their own tips and knowledge and what investigations they've done. And even the author of The Night Wounds Time there, Sean Sutherland, participates in the group. So there's actually a fair amount of information there if you want to follow and keep up with this case. So with just those few cards we have to look at, we got to try to theorize what happened here. I'm of the opinion that the police really torpedoed this case from the outset. Ignoring the vehicle as a source of evidence seems so sloppy. Honestly, how much work would it take just to go in there and poke around? You could have gotten some nice juicy fingerprints, maybe an unidentified hairs, some sort of forensic tip that really could have pushed the police in the right direction in investigating this case. And it's really so frustrating to have cases like this that probably could have been solved but can't be solved because of just errors that are made on the front end. My best guess is the girls went somewhere with some boys they trusted and then found themselves in a situation they couldn't get out of. I believe Mr. Elrod was part of this situation. I don't believe he was alone. I think there was at least one other person with him. I don't really buy his recanting of his confession. I mean, he was a young kid, and sadly, he was kind of broken from the way he acted. And I don't think he could mentally or emotionally hold in this level of secret. That's why he tells his new girlfriend what he did as a way to kind of unleash the burden. And when the police confronted him, his survival instincts kicked in, and he said what he needed to say to get out of trouble. Yes, he beat a polygraph. I understand that. But as we've discussed numerous times, there is a reason these machines are not used at trial or other court proceedings. There is just too much room for interpretation. And if the conductor of Elrod's polygraph test was inexperienced or distracted or predisposed to liking Elrod for some reason, we may not have gotten an accurate result. I'm not saying any of this happened. I'm just saying these are factors that can influence the outcome. Plus, if Elrod had some sort of undiagnosed mental illness, or if he just happened to have a strong understanding of how these machines work, he could have passed on his own without needing help from anyone. Those who've been listening to my podcast know that I've managed to manipulate polygraph results for my clients in the past by having them reevaluated by police to come out in my client's favor. Just because I know how the system works, I knew which buttons to press on the operator, and of course, nothing unethical, but in zealously representing my criminal clients, I would do everything I could to make sure that they would not be put in a bad position from taking a polygraph test. So because of, I think the police really bought into the polygraph results and dismissed Elrod as a suspect way too early. I think they should have spent more time investigating him, more interrogations with him to try to trip him up, really put the screws to him in some way to see if they could pull out some new information, which now effectively is completely unavailable, just like whatever fingerprints or forensic evidence could have been in the car. I also really worry that the police didn't search the Ritter Cemetery area well enough. Now, honestly, I'm not here to poop all over the police's work. I just think they had the wrong attitude from the outset, and that colored and handicapped their investigation. I don't believe a teenager would be able to bury a body well enough that police couldn't find it from a thorough search. So I kind of see one of two scenarios playing out if Elrod was involved in these two girls going missing. My first scenario is the simpler of the two. Elrod killed the girls and then dumped the bodies in the local Louisville Lake, which, to the best of my knowledge, was never searched. If you look at a map, the Ritter Cemetery was part of what used to be the Ritter Lake community, which is now underwater when the Louisville Lake was created. The lake is right off of Fitchhatchery Road. It literally runs the southern coast of this lake, and it is the only way to get to Ritter Cemetery. So I think if the boys, if there's two, properly weighted down the bodies and dumped them in the lake, they wouldn't, you know, if there's structures down there, it would be easy for the bodies to get tangled up in them and would have a difficult time resubmerging. I say this, of course, without ever actually having been to Ritter Cemetery. I'm just relying on what Google can show me. But I do think that's a likely course of action. The second possible scenario I see is that Elrod and his buddy or buddies buried the body somewhere in the nature preserve. This place, as you would expect, is just full of trees. The cemetery kind of winds its way through the trees. It's not a nice squared-off plot of land. There's even, I mean, the trees come through the cemetery and whatnot. I think it would be difficult to do a search to find a shallow grave without a truly coordinated effort. And again, I really have reservations in giving the police the benefit of the doubt on this point because of how they acted at the beginning of this case. I imagine they did search Ritter Cemetery, and it's a good chunk of land. Like I said, it's not an easy land to search, and didn't see anything. They probably searched into the woods for a few dozen feet and didn't see anything and then moved on. But the trees are so thick, looking at satellite pictures, you have a hard time following the road that leads into the cemetery. So Elrod could have gone 30 feet off in any one direction from the cemetery, buried the bodies, and they wouldn't be found. Now, the flaw in this theory, too, is it's so dense, it would be hard to dig with all these tree roots and whatnot. So that's why it's not my favorite scenario. But they could do, again, they could have gone out from the cemetery 30 feet. They could have just gone off the road 30 feet. And you would not see a shallow grave, from what I can tell looking at pictures and whatnot, until you were right on top of it. And so that's why you would need a very coordinated search and rescue type of effort to find a grave under these conditions, in my opinion. And so that's our episode on this one. I wish I could have been able to dig deeper into this case. There just isn't much information online. You know, older cases don't have a plethora of internet coverage. And I'm not in a position where I can go do a whole lot of in-person research. I can't fly over to Dallas and see what I can dig up. I am encouraged by the fact that there's a Facebook group that's so dedicated to finding out who knows what happened to these girls. I'm really appreciative of Mr. Sutherland's research efforts. I really regret not having the book before doing this episode, and I would encourage y'all who are interested to check out that book and see everything that's in there. I'm assuming he's had, since he lives in the area, he would have direct access to witnesses and easier access to police reports and whatnot than me as a goober sitting over here in central Alabama would. I appreciate Chloe sending the topic. I feel like I haven't done as good a job with it as I should, but that's the best I can do with the information that's out there. So some business I've been neglecting a little bit. We do have, as always, new members in our Facebook group. Please welcome Kim, Matthew, Chris, Morgan, Dave, Sydney, and Jude into our ranks. We are always in need of new minions. So please join the group if you're listening and you want to be a part of the show's future. Again, we've voted on what episodes get played when, kind of the general direction of what types of episodes y'all like hearing. I am trying to build this around y'all. To join the group, just go to facebook.com/killingmissinghidden. That'll get you to our podcast page. There's a link for the group from there. To get in the group, there's 3 questions you have to answer. If you don't answer the questions, you ain't getting in the group. They are easy. You can answer them, I promise. It's just to make sure that the people who want to join have actually listened to this podcast and aren't going to spam us with why we should be selling some great new weight loss product. Which, totally off the subject, but I've been asked twice now to become a brand ambassador for athletic and weight loss stuff. And I'm thinking, why are you picking a true crime show hosted by a guy that looks like George Costanza to pimp your getting in shape ideas? But I digress. I'm proud to announce our little podcast passed 15,000 downloads last week. It took us 5 months to reach 10,000 downloads, but only really less than a month to reach 15,000. That's really awesome. It's really amazing how fast we're growing, and it's 100% because of y'all. I appreciate all of y'all. I mean, I'd be tickled to have 100 people listening to me, so to have this much success is actually rather humbling. Please keep sharing the show, and let's keep growing those numbers. When we reach 25,000, we're going to have some special giveaways. I'm already working on it because I know we'll get there. If we keep at our current pace, it'll be sometime in October. So for those giveaways, you'll definitely want to be following us on Instagram. We're kmh.podcast. You'll definitely want to be a member of our Facebook group. And you'll definitely want to listen to our episode so you know what we have coming. But at least one thing I've got working on I think will be really, really cool. I may just keep it for myself. The greatest compliment you can give to us is sharing us with your friends. Second biggest one is subscribing to our show. We love reviews and ratings, of course, but it's really subscribers that butter our biscuits. And let's make sure you don't leave here today with a nice little palate cleanser. Here's what Mr. Eli has picked out for us this week. Why did the kid eat his homework? Indeed, why would this child eat his homework? Well, it's because his teacher said it would be a piece of cake. Gotta love Eli. Just finds. I wish I had his talent at picking out jokes. If there was a career for that, he'd be set. Who knows? Maybe he'll turn into a comedian. All right. Enough of me babbling. Let's do a goodbye with some nice southern rock. We'll steal some lyrics from Lynyrd Skynyrd. If I leave here tomorrow, would you still remember me? For I must be traveling on now. And that's where I'm going to stop it, so you have that nice little earworm buried into your brain, and you're going to have to go look up Freebird to satisfy it. Thank you as always. So appreciative to y'all. Please know that we love having y'all listen. We care about y'all. Always want your feedback. Always want your thoughts and opinions. Even if, you know, there's things you don't like about what we're doing and think we can do it better, that's why we do business at the end, because people said, I don't want to sit through that to get to the story. So let us know. And everybody stay safe out there. We all know the world's crazy. Please don't hurt our listener numbers. Don't be selfish like that. I need y'all to be healthy so you can continue to listen every Tuesday. All right, with that, I'll shut up. Y'all be good. This is Brad, heading out.
Thank you for listening to Killing, Missing, Hidden. Make sure to rate, subscribe, and share. Questions? Email us at info@kmhpodcast.com.